our study of the Judges, we left off last time talking about Samson and the oppression of the Philistines. We noted that Samson was somewhat different from the other judges in that he did not lead a military conquest. Samson's battles were personal. We find that he took a wife in chapter 14 of folks other than the Israelites. She was a Philistine. And in verses 1 through 4, I know I'm looking at it, we learned that this was according to the plan of God. Well, I'll be. Let me find it. Just lost the verse. Yes. That is correct. This was the beginning of the plan of God to deliver the Israelites from the Philistines. We talked about the chain of events and the providence involved in the plan of God. We talked about how that the riddle that Samson told was a part of this, and how that his wife betrayed him in the riddle, and how then that as the events transpired, his wife was given to someone else. He sought vengeance, and one thing led to another, and ultimately Samson was captured by the Philistines. His eyes put out. Of course, he was subjected to the grinding wheel in chapter 16, and then in his death, as he caused the pillars of the Temple of Dagon to fall, he killed 3,000 Philistines in his death, verse 27. That passage that I'm looking for is verse 4. Well, I was looking at it now, I couldn't see it. It says, but his father and his mother knew not that it was of Jehovah, for he sought an occasion against the Philistines. But when I'm looking right at it, I can't see it. But that sets the stage for the discussion of how God is going to use Samson in the deliverance of the Philistines, or from the Philistines. As we continue in the book of Judges, one of the things that impresses us is how that once again Israel continued, and Randy, you pointed this out in chapter 17, there in verse 6, how that they continued to serve the various idols. There it goes. Now, here we have the list of the judges or deliverers. We noted that this period of time covered how long? About 300 years. How many judges? 15 judges. Okay, counting Abimelech. And Bruce, tell me why that Abimelech is kind of strange to be on this list of judges. Okay, he killed them all but one, and appointed himself as king, essentially, over the Israelites. But nonetheless, in most lists of the judges, you'll find Abimelech. In our study, we've dropped down, we've talked about Samson somewhat, and in this period of the judges, I asked you to read the remainder of the book of Judges, and you found, I'm sure, some rather interesting things in this portion of time. One is, we found that the Ephraimites were those that felt betrayed in the battle that Jephthah engaged with the Ammonites, because they weren't always called upon for every battle in which the Israelites fought. Benjamin, in chapters 19 through 21, refused to punish some wicked men and for a crime that was committed, and other tribes nearly destroyed the whole tribe of Benjamin in revenge. What I want you to see is in these latter few chapters of the book of Judges, they were just fighting and fussing even among themselves. And that was typical of the attitude that prevailed, the tribe of Dan. They felt crowded in the little area that was given to them, and we can read about some of that described in Joshua chapter 10, or chapter 19 it is, verses 40 through verse 48, but they were unhappy where they were. The text tells us that they sought to find other land, and they took the city of Laish near the source of the Jordan River up to the north. And when we sometimes think of the cities
that characterize the extremity of the land that was promised to the Israelites, we think of Dan to Beersheba. And, of course, this is the ancient city of Laish, where the Danites moved. So this period of the Judges concludes in Judges chapter 21 with this statement. Judges chapter 21, beginning in verse 25, it says, "In those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did that which is right in his own sight." Now, 300 years, about 15 judges, and we've got everyone doing as they please. When we think of 300 years of history, is that really a long time in respect of world events? We're really not all that long. But yet we find that during this 300 years, a radical change has occurred in the people of God from those who came in and conquered the land under the leadership of Joshua. Joshua has reminded them of all the great things that God has done. And Joshua has reminded them that if you worship and serve other gods, God will destroy you out of this good land. And where's the text where we read that? All right, in Deuteronomy 4, where Moses told them, Deuteronomy 8 and 28 through 30, and then Joshua's statements. All right, in Joshua chapter 23 specifically, verses 14 through 16, where he affirmed that everything that God had promised, he had completed, and if you worship and serve other gods, he will destroy you out of this land. Now, here in 300 years, about 305 years, we find them doing as they please. No king in Israel, no central government, they're doing as they please. God is allowing his people to be oppressed because of their own wickedness. Now, as you begin the book of 1 Samuel, I want to turn there. We're going to skip over the book of Ruth. And I want to study with you about 1 Samuel as we continue the period of the Judges. And Richard, would you mind to do some reading for me, please? Beginning at verse 1, would you read down through verse 5, please?
1 Samuel 1:1-5. Now there was a certain man of Ramathan Zophim of the hill country of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuph, an Ephraimite. And he had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other was Hanina. Hanina had children, but Hannah had no children. And this man went up out of his city from year to year to worship and to sacrifice unto Jehovah of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, priests unto Jehovah, were there. And when the day came that Elkanah sacrificed, he gave to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and her daughters portions. But unto Hannah he gave a double portion, for he loved Hannah, but Jehovah had shut up her womb.
All right, we've got a problem. And the problem is, Eli and Hannah can't have any children. And her Eli's other wife, I'm trying to think of a way to say that, evidently was able to have children. And the discussion between Hannah and, what's her name, Peninnah, was agitated, to say the least, trying to think of a way to put that. In verse 7, it tells us she provoked her. So it would seem that Peninnah made fun of Hannah because she couldn't have any children. And Hannah, in verse 9, it begins to tell us that she makes a vow unto God. And what is her vow, David? Verse 11.
Not forget my enemy. Well,
All right, it does. So she is promising that this child will serve the Lord. She will devote him to the service of the Lord all the days of his life if she can have a child. Interestingly enough, she, in verse 15, the text tells us, "But I poured out my soul before Jehovah." Then in verse 17, "Then Eli answered and said, Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thy petition that thou hast asked of him." What's about to happen? About to have a child. What's the child's name? Samuel. All right, here we're introduced now to these events involving Samuel. In verse 27, "For this child I prayed, and Jehovah hath given me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore also I have granted him to Jehovah. As long as he liveth, he is granted to Jehovah," and he worshipped Jehovah there. Hannah prayed, the first few verses of chapter 2, but beginning in verse 12, it sets the stage regarding the sons of Eli. Now, who is Eli? All right, what kind of fellows are his sons? They're bad folks. Why are they so bad? What indicates that they're so bad? Verses 12 through verse 17, what are they doing? Pardon me? They didn't know the Lord. That's right, verse 12 tells us. But in verse 13, let's read. It says, "And the custom of the priests and of the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant came while the flesh was boiling with a flesh hook and three teeth in his hand, and he struck it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the flesh hook brought up, the priest took therewith. So they did in Shiloh unto all the Israelites that came thither. Yea, before they burnt the fat, the priest's servant came and said to the man that was sacrificed, give flesh to roast for the priest, for he will not have boiled flesh of thee, but raw. And if the man said unto him, They will surely burn the fat first, then take as much as thy soul desireth, then he would say, Nay, but thou shalt give it me now, and if not, I will take it by force. And the sin of the young men was very great before Jehovah, for all the men despised the offering of Jehovah." Now, somebody explain to me, what is it that these priests are doing? Taking more than their share, but there's something else wrong with this. All right, they're taking it by force. Taking it first. Here's the problem. Let's go back and read what they were supposed to do. Turn back to Leviticus chapter 7. Leviticus chapter 7. In Leviticus chapter 7, Chris Simmons, would you read some for me, please? Beginning in verse 23. Leviticus chapter 7, verse 23. And if you would like, let's just read down through verse 27 for now, and then we'll pick up and go again, please. Here was the commandment of God regarding the fat of the ox, the sheep, or the goat. Not to eat it. Verse 28, if you would please, down through verse 35, please.
Sons of Aaron who offers the blood of the peace offerings and the fat, the right thigh shall be released
taken the rest of the wave offering and the tithe contribution, the sons of Israel from the sacrifice of the peace offering, and have given them to Aaron the priest and to his sons as their due forever from the sons of Israel.
All right, what was to be done first? You see, the complaint was these priests would take this flesh hook and they would get theirs first. And if someone said, well, let's burn the fat first and then you can take what you want, they said, no, you'll give it to me now, and if you don't, I'll take it by force. You see, the problem was, who's first? Well, what they were doing here was wrong. They were placing themselves before God. They wanted theirs first before the sacrifice was made unto God. Now, what that tells us is how that these men were wicked men. They wanted theirs first before the fat was burned unto the Lord. And if you don't give it first, then we'll take it. Now, that tells you how evil the priests were. Now, that brings us to the discussion of Samuel and Eli. Notice, if you will, in verse 12, the sons of Eli were base men. They knew not Jehovah. Here's the kind of practice that characterized the sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas. As we continue into the second chapter, of 1 Samuel, it says, but Samuel ministered before Jehovah, being a child, girded with a linen ephod. Moreover, his mother made him a little robe and brought it to him from year to year when she came up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. And Eli blessed Elkanah and his wife and said, Jehovah give thee seed of this woman for the petition which was asked of Jehovah. And they went into their own home. And Jehovah visited Hannah, and she conceived and bare three sons and two daughters. And the child Samuel grew before Jehovah. Now verse 22, look carefully. It says, now Eli was very old, and he heard all that his sons did unto all Israel, and how that they lay with the women that did service at the door of the tent of meeting. And he said unto them, why do ye such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all this people. Nay, my sons, for it is no good report that I hear. Ye make Jehovah's people to transgress. If one man sin against another, God shall judge him. But if a man sin against Jehovah, who shall entreat for him? Notwithstanding, they hearken not unto to the voice of their father, because Jehovah was minded to slay them. And the child Samuel grew on and increased in favor, both with Jehovah and also with men. These verses simply tell us just how evil Hophni and Phinehas really were. They committed fornication with the women that did service at the door of the tent of meeting. And it appears that Eli has very little, if any, control over his sons to keep them from these evil practices. Yet we've got a problem now with Eli. Look, if you will, at verse 29. Verse 29, a man of God came to Eli. And it tells us in verse 29, wherefore kick ye at my sacrifice and at mine offerings, which I have commanded in my habitation, and honorest thy sons above me, to make yourselves fat with the chiefest of all the offerings of Israel, my people. Therefore Jehovah the God of Israel saith, I said indeed, that thy house and the house of thy father should walk before me forever. But now Jehovah saith, far be it from me, for them that honor me will I honor. And that they that despise me shall be lightly esteemed. I'll say that right. Behold, the days come that I will cut off thine arm and the arm of thy father's house, that there shall not be an old man in thy house. And thou shalt behold the affliction of my habitation and all the wealth which God shall give Israel, and there shall not be an old man in thy house forever. And the man of thine whom I shall cut off from mine altar shall be to consume thine eyes and to grieve thy heart, and all the increase of thy house shall die in the flower of their age. And this shall be the sign unto thee that shall come upon thy two sons, on Hophni and Phinehas, in one day they shall die, both of them, and I will raise me up a faithful priest that shall do according to that which is in my heart, in my mind. Now let's pause right there. What's God just said through this man to Eli? Eli's house, what's going to happen?
That his family will be stricken of old age.
All right, they're going to be cut off. There's not going to be any old age in his house. In other words, his sons are going to die while they're young. Yes, David?
Yeah, same pattern of thought there, going back to Eli. He wasn't really taking care of this. He couldn't have his sons removed.
Well, you would like to think so, yes. He was not taking care of business. That's right. That's exactly right. You were to declare his rebellion and he would be stoned to death and put away the wickedness from among Israel. Eli didn't do that. And so he allowed his son. In fact, I think it's interesting in verse 29 where the question is asked, essentially, why do you honor your sons above me? Now granted, we must love our children and provide for them, but who has first place? God does. And Eli evidently did not recognize or comply with that principle. In the third chapter, beginning in verse 1, note that the word of Jehovah was precious in those days. There was no frequent vision. What does that mean toward this latter period of the judges? All right, he didn't talk to them much. He didn't communicate with them that much. The word was considered precious. We note in verse 4 of chapter 3, Jehovah called unto Samuel, and he said, "Here am I." And how did that proceed? Who did Samuel think was calling him? He thought that was Eli, and so he would go to Eli and say, "Here am I." Well, it wasn't Eli that was calling him. It was God that was calling him, and how did Samuel learn that? Eli told him. He said, "It's not me, it's God that's calling you. And what are you to say the next time you hear that?" "I'm listening. Speak, for thy servant heareth." You see that at verse 10. Well, what was it then that God said to young Samuel? Melissa?
That Eli's house was going to be judged, that Eli was
All right, and what caused all that?
Because Eli refused to punish his son.
That's right. He let them do as they please. In verse 13, "For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons did bring a curse upon themselves, and he restrained them not." David, this is to your point. Eli had somewhat to do with this. He could have prevented it. He could have stopped it once it started. He could have called upon them to be stoned to death. But he didn't. And because he didn't, he's responsible in that respect. And these things that God is saying unto Samuel, when Eli calls Samuel in and said, "What did God say to you?" I think that would be real easy, Jenny, to tell Eli what God said. What did Samuel do? He told him everything. In verse 18 it said, "Samuel told him every whit, and hid nothing from him. And he said, 'It is Jehovah, let him do what seemeth him good.'" And so it was that Samuel grew and was established to be a prophet in verse 20. Now, when you get into the fourth chapter of the book of 1 Samuel, the army, the Philistines that Samuel has engaged in, or Samson rather, has engaged in battle, and gained evidently a victory. It would seem that the Philistine army wants to fight some more. They encamp in Aphek, as you'll see in chapter 4 and in verse 1. But we've got a problem here, especially during this time. Who is it that's kind of in charge of the army of Israel now? What's going on in Israel now? We've got Eli, we've got Samuel, we've got Hophni and Phinehas.
Well,
They're doing what's right in their own eyes. That's right. If you'll drop down in the text to verse 2, it says, the Philistines put themselves in array against Israel, and when they joined battle, Israel was smitten before the Philistines, and they slew of the army in the field about 4,000 men. 4,000 men. Now, if you go back to Joshua chapter 6, when they came into the promised land, what was the first city of conquest? City of Jericho. In verse 6, it tells us that Joshua the son of Nun called the priests and said unto them, take up the ark of the covenant, and let seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of Jehovah. And they said unto the people, pass on, encompass the city, and let the armed men pass on before the ark of Jehovah. And we read a lot about the ark of the Lord here in Joshua chapter 6. Now, the ark of the covenant generally meant that God's presence was among the people. We saw that to be true when they crossed over the Jordan River. Remember, when the feet of the priests reached into the water, the waters parted of the Jordan River, and the people went across on dry ground, God was with them. When they conquered the city of Jericho, they're following the Ark of the Covenant, God's presence is with them. But they think now, because of the Philistines and their oppression here in 1 Samuel chapter 4, that 4,000 of us have been killed. What we need to do is go get the Ark of the Covenant. Right? That'll turn the tide. We'll get the Ark of the Covenant. So they go over to Shiloh and get the Ark of the Covenant and bring it over to Aphek. What happened? It's captured. Along with 30,000 more soldiers being killed of the Israelite army, including the two sons. That's right, Hophni and Phinehas, Eli's sons, just as God had said back over in chapter 2 and in verse 31 and following. The sons of Eli are now killed. Now the Ark of the Covenant. You would like to think that where it was, God would be. But not necessarily in their favor. I put this up here so I would not forget it. 30,000 plus the 4,000. 34,000 people defeated over here or killed over here at Aphek by the Philistines during this uprising. Any questions or comments just here? They took the Ark of the Covenant. They did. You'll note in verse 11 of chapter 4. It says, the ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were slain. Now, as things begin to be reported regarding this, in verse 17, it says, verse 15 rather, that Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were set so that he could not see. And the man said unto Eli, I am he that came out of the army, and I fled today out of the army. And he said, how went the matter, my son? And he that brought the tidings answered and said, Israel is fled before the Philistines, and there hath been also a great slaughter among the people. And thy two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the ark of God is taken. And it came to pass, when he made mention of the ark of God, that Eli fell from off his seat backward by the side of the gate and brake his neck and died, for he was an old man and heavy, and he judged Israel 40 years. Eli didn't receive bad news very good, did he? Bad news. Couldn't get much worse. Your sons are dead. The ark of God has been taken by the Philistines. I want to talk with you just a little bit about the Ark of the Covenant. Described as a portable chest along with the mercy seat and cherubim, was considered the most sacred object of the Israelites during the period of the wilderness wandering. And why, again, we must ask the question. What did it symbolize?
God's presence.
God's presence. It symbolized God's presence. But God was not with them here. Within the Ark of the Covenant, there were two stone tablets containing the Ten Commandments, the golden pot of manna, which God had miraculously preserved, and Aaron's rod that budded. Once again, these elements were there to remind them of God's presence, the great things that God had done for them in their history. Now, this chart is one that was provided in the series by Richie Thetford. I thought about deleting it, but I'll throw it in here because we'll come to it a bit later in our study. Nothing is known about what became of the Ark of the Covenant. When Jerusalem was destroyed in 586 B.C., there's just no more information about it beyond that. Some have made all kinds of speculative theories, but be that as it may, we know that it did exist from the time that it was fashioned until the time that it was taken by King Nebuchadnezzar in 536, after which it just ceases from biblical history. But what we do know is that God could take care of the Ark of the Covenant, even though it was in the hands of the enemies. When the Philistines took it, where did they take it? Chapter 5. All right, to their capital, which was the city of Ashdod. And what was in Ashdod? Their idol, Dagon. What was Dagon? Fish god. Their fish god, that's right. And when they took the Ark of the Covenant, what happened to Dagon? He fell over on his face before the Ark of God, verse 3. And you'll note in verse 4, in the morning, they saw what had happened, and what did they do to Mr. Dagon? Oh, they set him back up, but then what happened? He fell over again. Yeah, he fell over again. And his arms fell off, yes. And his head fell off, yes. And what happened to the people of Ashdod? Started getting sick. These tumors, the text tells us. Some have referred to those as boils. Nonetheless, it was not very pleasant for them. And they began to break out in these things. Now, if you look at the text, the question is asked in verse 8, what shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel? And they answered, let the ark of the God of Israel be carried about unto Gath. And they carried the ark of the God of Israel thither. Well, we don't want it in Ashdod because of these things that are happening to us. Let's get rid of it. Let's take it to Gath. What happened in Gath? Same thing. All right, so let's get rid of it. Let's take it somewhere else. Where did they take it? Well, they took it to Ekron. What happened there? Well, not good things. They were deadly discomforted, or discomforted, the text tells us in verse 11 and verse 12, the men that died not were smitten with tumors, and the cry of the city went up unto heaven. Chapter 6, the Ark of Jehovah was in the country of the Philistines for 7 months. And the question is asked, what shall we do with it? You see that in verse 2? This is not good. So where was it then taken? Beth Shemesh, that's right, in Judah. It was taken back to Judah. Now, interestingly enough, look, if you will, at verse 7. In verse 7, it says, now therefore, chapter 6, verse 7, now therefore, take and prepare you a new cart and 2 milk kine on which there hath come no yoke, and tie the kine to the cart and bring their calves home from them, and take the ark of Jehovah and lay it upon the cart, and put the jewels of gold which he returned him for the trespass offering in the coffer by the side thereof, and send it away that it may go and see if it goeth up by the way of its own border to Beth Shemesh. Then he hath done us this great evil. But if not, then we know that it is not his hand that smote us. It was a chance that happened unto us. Well, where did it go? It went to Beth Shemesh. And as it went with these 2 milk cows on a new cart, things seemed to be pretty good. But then it was taken to Kiriath Jearim. Pronounce that, if you would, for me, Richard, please. 1 Samuel 6. Verse 7-1. Richard has the phonics markings in his Bible. There you go. And they took it to the house of Abinadab. where it stayed for 20 years. Now that relieved the Philistines somewhat, but it didn't put the Ark of God back where it was supposed to be. It's in Judah, but where's it supposed to be? All right, it's going to eventually be brought to Jerusalem. And who's going to bring it to Jerusalem? David. King David is going to bring the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. Well, you would like to think at this point things go fairly well. But we're going to jump ahead here for just a moment. And we'll come back to 1 Samuel chapter 8. But turn in your Bible to 1 Chronicles chapter 13. Question? Okay. Okay. 1 Chronicles chapter 13. In 1 Chronicles chapter 13. Well, that's 2 Chronicles. I wonder that didn't look right. 1 Chronicles. Chapter 13. Yes. Beginning in verse 1. We know that David is making preparation to return the ark or to bring the ark to the city of Jerusalem. And how does he prepare to do that? Pardon me?
First he has a new cart.
All right, he gets a new cart. And then what does he do?
Procession.
Makes a big procession, and he's got oxen pulling the ark. And the oxen begin to stumble, and Uzzah puts up his hand to steady the ark. And what happens to Uzzah? He dies. Yeah, he dies. And why? That's right. He wasn't supposed to touch it. He was not a Levite. Go to the 15th chapter of 1 Chronicles. In verse 2, it says, "Then David said, None ought to carry the ark of God but the Levites. For them hath Jehovah chosen to carry the ark of Jehovah and to minister unto him forever. And David assembled all Israel at Jerusalem to bring up the ark of Jehovah unto his place which he had prepared for it. And David gathered together the sons of Aaron, the Levites, the sons of Kohath." And we see numerous names given of these individuals. But if you'll drop down to verse 13, it says, "For because ye bare it not at the first, Jehovah our God made a breach upon us, for that we sought him not according to the ordinance. So the priests and the Levites sanctified themselves to bring up the ark of Jehovah, the God of Israel, and the children of the Levites bare the ark of God upon their shoulders with the staves thereon, as Moses commanded, according to the word of Jehovah." Now it would seem that the way that David is trying to transport the ark, it was successful with the Philistines. Well, not really, because the Philistines began to die wholesale because it was in their presence. And it doesn't work with David either. God had prescribed how the ark was to be transported. And the very picture of the thing, or the image that we see of the thing, was to indicate how it was to be carried on the shoulders of the priest with these staves. Do we see that? Not on a new cart pulled by oxen. Now David messed up, but he found out because you didn't do it the right way, then we have not been successful in returning the Ark of the Covenant to its place. And we need to stop and ponder that for just a moment. Okay? Well, this map simply shows the places that it went before it was brought back to the land of Judah. Okay? Then it was eventually, by David, brought to Jerusalem. Any questions or comments just here?
Well, the thought, David basically was would have known more about the law. Requirements for carrying the ark, and that he probably should have went to priests in the first place and consulted with them before they even tried.
But he didn't do that. He did not do that. He says we should have done that because we didn't do that.
You have to considered, though, the ark was lost long before David even came, I mean, before Saul.
Oh, yes.
Long before the kings.
That's so right.
Most likely they hadn't had the ark in most of David's lifetime, so that wouldn't have been something that they would have been familiar with, even though it was there, since it wasn't in Judah, in the land of Israel. Most likely they didn't spend a lot of time learning about that, since
yes.
It had been taken.
That's right. And of course, the period of this portion of the period of the Judges was, what should we say, a period of rebellion. And that's why it's been taken. So, that's right.
But, you know, but it seemed like in chapter 13, David did consult all the leaders and also the priests and the Levites. And the Levites should have, you know,
Well, they should have known that. Yes, we might reason and say, yes, they should have known that. Of course, by the time of David, you know, there are a lot of things that are taking place that we say should have been known. But the very existence of the appointment of kings and all of this was contrary to what God had desired. So we've got a lot of things that are going on that we say, well, they should have known better. Yeah, they should have. But they didn't. David? Yes. Yes. When they crossed the Jordan, the ark went before them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just think, well, I don't know how closely they followed the history or just didn't bother to remember.
Well, you know, one of the things that I want us to consider during the period of the Judges that we've talked about, and we'll talk about this some more, is with the passing of time, what do we always tend to do? Forget. And that was the very, very thing that God cautioned them about. Teach your children, lest when they come into this land and partake of these things, they forget.
And the problem we see is that throughout the whole time of the Judges, you know, we're talking 300 years, the Levites were obviously not teaching,
right.
Not learning. They weren't teaching their kids, so they weren't teaching the people. I mean, we just look at Eli's sons and how evil they were. And then, of course, we have Samuel, but he was one man. And then when his sons were even bad, so now we have the kings. So we have the Levites for a very long time having obviously been studying and learning and teaching fully.
That's right. We've got a problem.
Therefore, the people are not going to fully know. And they probably have neglected the information about the ark. They hadn't had the ark.
So that's right.
Now they have to learn it. They learned it the hard way. Because that's what we all find.
And God had told them that. That was the purpose of these oppressors, to turn them back. Ultimately, that was the purpose of the period of captivity, to turn them back. Yes.
So we lose all that and we suffer because of ignorance.
Yes. Yes. You know, you as a class have brought up something that I think we need to probably ponder for just a moment. When we think of the failure on behalf of priests and the failure on behalf of parents and so forth, and how long it took before it began to show up as far as consequences upon the nation, one generation. Just took one generation.
A lot of times people will say when I'm talking with them, they want their children to make their own choices as far as matters of religion. And I really, if you don't teach them to start with, how can they compare anything? And so I think that's a big fault a lot of times when people will say, well, I won't influence them. I want them to make their own choices.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's generally because that's what they did.
Probably.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Very good. Well, interestingly enough, after the period of the Judges, they're faithful to God, and of course we've got this circle that they go round and round the horn on. But ultimately, God makes good and takes them captive. And even after the period of the Babylonian captivity, when they come back during the days of the restoration, what does Nehemiah find regarding the priesthood and the sacrifices that are being offered? Pardon me? What does he find?
They were giving in. They were marrying foreign wives. They weren't teaching people right. The people weren't following the law.
That's exactly
and
right.
And they even allowed the enemies of God in.
live in the temple. That's right. That's right. And consequently, in making place for the enemy to live in the temple, the grain and goods for priests has been thrown out. And what are the priests doing? They're working out in the fields because the sustenance for the priest is not being provided for them. And that's what Nehemiah finds when he comes back from just having led them in the rebuilding of the walls around the city of Jerusalem and during the days of Malachi. What are the priests doing? All right, they're offering the lame, the blind, the sick, that which is about to die anyway, and expecting somehow that God's going to approve of that. And God said, offer it to your governors and see if they will accept it. And so this attitude of apathy and beyond or worse has been a historical cycle of the children of Israel. Well, yes, time and time again, they said that in the book of Malachi. That's right. Well, as we look at the period of the judges during the oppression, battle and unrest seem to be characteristic of the majority, but that doesn't mean that's what everyone did. When we have such vast wickedness that exists on behalf of the people of Israel, what has there always been? A remnant. Always been a remnant. We don't read a lot about the remnant, but we know that there's always been a remnant, and during this period, we read about Ruth, the book of Ruth. And of course, Ruth was a maiden from Moab, an ancestor, as described in the lineage, as it were, of Christ. She came to Bethlehem with her mother-in-law, Naomi. She married Boaz, and had a son named Obed, who had a son named Jesse, who had a son named David, and that just rings all kinds of bells, doesn't it, in the lineage of Christ. So we can trace some very important events back to at least one who was faithful during this time that we're studying about. Yes, Ruth was from Moab. Naomi was an Israelite. Ruth was Naomi's daughter-in-law. And when Naomi's son died, Ruth came back with Naomi to the land of Israel, where she met Boaz, who was an Israelite. And so she's in the lineage of Christ.
And he was from the prophet Christ.
Yeah. 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 Very interesting study of genealogy. All right. All right.